G'day humans, welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. I'm currently in London, old London town, old Blighty, as we like to call it, for a whistle-stop tour. It's really a whistle-stop around the world tour, hustling the podcast, encouraging people to join the Uncomfortable Conversations community. I've been doing a bunch of podcasts all over the place. You'll see me pop up on some of the biggies. Went to LA for a day, went to San Francisco for a day, went to New York for a day. Then Austin for a day, and then back to New York for a day, and then London for a couple of days. Let me tell you a little piece of advice. Don't do that. Don't do that. Maybe more than a day in each place would be advisable. Nonetheless, I want to bring you this now while I'm away, which is a conversation that I just had with the Fifth Column guys. Many of you may know this podcast. They're a fabulous trio. I don't know why. I feel like I'm speaking like Ed Sullivan. A fabulous trio of young gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, the Fifth Column. They are based in New York City. And while I'm in town, every time I'm there, I always want to stop by their studios and, you know, squeeze their little cheeks and look at their rosy little faces, with the exception of one of them, Camille, who has fled New York for sunnier climes in California. Nonetheless, enough about them. Let's talk about me, which is what I did too much of on their very show a few months before my departure from Legacy Media. And some keen observers noticed at the time that I parted ways with my ABC radio show that just a few months prior, I'd been hinting at some possible issues at the broadcaster, or at least at my tenure at the broadcaster, on their very show. So we recap that, we revisit that, they grill me about that, and we have a good time talking about all sorts of other things that are going on in the news. If you've heard this on their feed, I'm sorry. If you haven't heard this, then enjoy it. And if you want more of them, go to wetafifth.substack.com. And yeah, I've recorded some fantastic stuff that you can look forward to. Things that'll be on YouTube. I just sat down with Jimmy Carr, the English comic, last night at a swanky little place in Mayfair. We had a videographer. We're going to put it on YouTube. It's not coming out until his Netflix special drops in a few weeks' time. Outside in New York City, I sat down with Coleman Hughes and Jesse Single. I went for a walk with Thomas Chatterton Williams, all these wonderful people who were very generous to give me their time. So that's all coming up. We've got heaps in the bag over the next month or two, not to mention the live tour with Douglas Murray. So it's all happening here at Uncomfortable Conversations. If you want to be part of the community, if you want to hear all the bonus stuff without ever having to endure ads or shorter cropped episodes, you know what to do. You pull your phone out right now. You're uncomfortableconversations.substack.com. Yeah, subscribe. Anyway, I'm about to jump on a plane and come back to my homeland. I hope you're well. I'll see you there. Enjoy me on the Fifth Column.
Greetings and welcome back to another exciting installment of the Fifth Column Podcast. This is your weekly rhetorical assault on the news cycle of people that make it, and occasionally ourselves. I'm Camille Foster. I'm so delighted to be here on this magnificent Wednesday following a Super Tuesday. I'm joined by Matt Welch, Michael Moynihan, and Moynihan is
yes,
what I just said.
Morning,
I'm going to leave it at that. Today, he's Moynihan. Because he's a little handsy, as the ladies right. know. But we're also joined by a special guest who joins us from very, very far away, almost as far away as you can get, our wonderful, dear friend, beloved.
Right, I'm literally sitting in the same room, Camille. Yeah. I'm sitting in New York City with Matt.
It's so great.
Also, I'm privileged that
Did join us from far away. You traveled.
Oh, I see. True. Yeah, that's right. And the only purpose of my trip was to do this show. I love that of all of the surnames on this show, it was not Zepps that was a problem, but Moynihan. Yeah.
Which you spelled in Moynihan various ways over your career.
Briefly, right? When I was here, I got sick and tired of people saying, oh, what is that, Schweppes?
Yeah.
What is that, Schweppes? Where's that from? Speps? Zepps?
Well, were you doing shows out in Long Island or something?
And I was just like, you know what? I don't know how many times it was misspelled by customs officials who were notating my refugee grandmother's details during the Holocaust.
So when you got to Ellis Island, you changed your own name.
That's exactly right. It was pretty much like that. I never changed it.
I just double Z. I phoneticized
it. There was something zappy about Z E P P S. But now, for everybody who wants to look me up, S Z E P S. That's what you type into the YouTube to get all the great content.
Can we? And I know that We have Super Tuesday. We have Camille, who's, we should put him up on the screen, by the way. He's not on the screen. And we love looking at you,
there
Camille.
Look at him.
There is smiling mug.
How often does he get his teeth cleaned, do you think?
Does he get his? I don't. Why?
Because they're veneers.
Because they're so yellow. Veneers. Is that what you're saying?
I don't even have to brush. No, just stay white.
Your teeth so yellow when you smile, cars slow down. That is not. It doesn't work as well without the black scent. Can you realize the importance of the black scent? Can we just get off before we get into the news of the day? I want to talk about Josh Zepps and his. job difficulties at home, which when I read about, mentioned this podcast.
Literally mentioned this podcast.
Literally. And it said in the, what was it? The Age?
It was in the Australian, which is a Rupert Murdoch paper, which is frequently trying to take pot shots at the public broadcaster.
Yeah.
Well, not the whole institution, just one particular individual. So last time I was on, I was talking about some, I was basically talking about, we were talking about the phenomenon of cancel culture more broadly.
And to give listeners who, if maybe they didn't listen to that episode, you had a show on ABC, which is the equivalent of NPR or BBC in Australia. A public broadcaster.
Called Wake Up.
Yes, exactly.
Called Wake Up Your Cunt.
Yeah, they changed the name. They thought that was a little
bit. When I left, they were like, can we finally get rid of the C word? No, Josh isn't there anymore. I mean, look, it's so funny that particular appearance is now connected to everything that went down with me. So, I mean, long story short, I am now in charge of a burgeoning multimedia empire, which people can follow at Uncomfortable Conversations, which is a Substack, and now a YouTube page, and now a live events company. We're bringing out Douglas Murray to Australia. Thank you very much.
I love it.
But so what happened was I was here and we were talking about cancel culture and then I mentioned that I'd done this this episode where there was a disagreement about the N word, and it was a bit of a brouhaha, shall we say?
Which you said very liberally on our podcast.
Yeah. I have never said that word on this show in public.
Well, I mean, before you started recording, you called Camille.
But it's fine. I insisted on it.
I just refer to Camille that in private. No, not true. And so there was a general conversation about cancel culture, and I was saying, you know how these things work. You know, it's not exactly that you get threatened. It's just that there's a whiff of a smell about you, and everybody. And you know, next time your contract's up for renewal, you know. I was talking in general terms. Well, there's an individual at the aforementioned newspaper who, like, I mean, God bless his cotton socks for being so obsessed with everybody at the public broadcaster. He lives in his basement and tap 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 typing away on his typewriter, surrounded by candlelight. Like listening to every single thing.
So you have those in Australia too.
Candles? We have candles.
No, I meant those.
Oh, those people. Those people.
Last decade.
So God bless you, Gerard, if you're listening. But he, and so we did this whole thing. And then I flew off. And I had a vacation in Europe after we last chatted.
Yeah.
And I'm in Lisbon. I'm with a buddy of mine.
Yeah.
Everything's great. I wake up in the morning and a Google alert pops up. And I'm like, oh, what's this? The headline. Let me read the headline.
Let's read the headline.
The headline of the media watchdog column is ABC presenter Josh Zepps expresses concern about a pervading cancel culture at the ABC.
Oh, It's not what you said.
That's not what I said at all.
It's absolutely what you meant, but you didn't actually say it.
In fact, I'm pretty sure I was clear that there was that this was a storm in a teacup and that the ABC was bigger than this.
And that you had someone there had your back.
Yeah, that's
which
right.
Turned out not to be true.
So the first line says of the article says the media watchdog exclusive segment makes he says this week's segment is so exclusive. That explanation is necessary. And then he goes to explain to the reader what podcasts are, who you people are, like what
broadcasting
is. I believe
he refers to us as the world famous. Something like that.
And anyway, he makes the point that basically what I was saying is that there is something uniquely problematic about the public broadcaster, which is not at all what I was saying. But what's interesting about that, and who knows whether or not that played a role in the eventual collapse of my relationship with my employer.
It doesn't help.
I think this is actually instructive about something that I'm getting more and more worried about, which is the impact that anti-cancel culture warriors, the anti-woke crowd, are having on cancel culture.
Yes.
Because there's, you know, if it wasn't for the fact, like, it is untenable for an organization that is constantly facing fire from bad actors who are going to twist every word and try to make it sound worse than it is to tolerate as much of a level of internal dissent as they could if they knew that people were going to, like, be reasonable. It's because of the intense fire that constantly comes and tries to stoke up fears about cancel culture from the right that the cancel – that people are kind of – forced to be a little bit more cancel-y because there's less scope for a big rambunctious sharing of ideas when those ideas might trigger the anti-woke people to go nuts.
I think one of the weird things that we've discovered, and I think you have discovered this too, we have not been on this beat at all. We've just been talking about this sort of broader phenomenon. We've never talked about cancel culture. We do an episode every week about cancel culture. We just kind of started talking about this stuff in like 2016 because it was all around us, right? And we were kind of early... what would you say? Canaries in the coal mine, I guess.
Yeah.
Nostradamuses.
The Rasputin. Rasputin without being rolled in the carpet and dumped in the Volga River.
And a lot of our friends who we had on, or people who became friends that we had on, it kept happening to them.
That's true.
But one of the things that I think is really interesting about when this stuff first comes out, you start saying, oh, well, this guy's talking about it too. That guy's interesting. And as it goes on for a number of years, you start realizing that some of the people you're talking to at the beginning are completely insane. And they're...
You're talking about Brett Weinstein.
What?
Women in particular.
What causes AIDS? I mean, come on. We don't know.
What does cause AIDS?
Everything causes AIDS.
What, you're asking me because I'm the gay at the table?
Yeah, Pfizer?
Fuck you.
Wow.
I mean, well, when he asked me what caused AIDS, I said, Josh.
Uh-oh, Gerard Henderson's going to write an article about
Gerard,
this.
Stop it. No more, mate.
Zeps blows lid on pervasive culture of AIDS.
Oh, my God.
Don't say blows lid.
He said blows lid, right? Is that what he said? Okay. I just want to make sure.
Isn't that what you guys used to do advice?
Yeah, of course. I'll be blowing some lids soon. But no, I think it's really interesting that these people that, you know, are just kind of your nominal allies because no one's talking about the issue. And as time goes on, you're like, wow, that person is totally insane. And I wish I never, but you can't help it. This, I mean, the people are like, well, you once talked to this person. I'm like, well, yeah, back then I didn't know who they were and they were sort of normal, but it deranges people and warps them over time. And if you see this in every aspect of politics, it's not just the kind of woke stuff. I saw this clip, I think it was in London, maybe it was in London, of a, you know, pro-Palestinian protester. Like losing their, I mean, there's something wrong with some of these people. They've gone so far that they think everybody who doesn't do X or Y is supporting.
Was this a white person or a Palestinian person?
Unclear.
Okay.
Because they were, you know, wrapped in a kafir. So it's kind of hard to tell.
Because I don't think it's rare necessarily for Islamists and jihadists to go be a little extra.
This was not an extra
I don't
jihadist.
Think this person
this was a regular.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
As my brother used to call them, the regulars. So anyway.
But I don't even, just to clarify, I don't think Gerard Henderson, who's this columnist, is a right-wing nut job. Like, right? No. Like, it's not, you don't need to
you
have gone
afraid of him,
Brett Weinstein. No. Honestly, these are people who have their beat, right?
Oh, to be clear, I'm not comparing him. I'm just saying that when, you know, in this, over time, of this stuff, these people that you are associated with at one time, you know, talking about woke stuff or, you know, which is a word that I try desperately to avoid these days. And it's also because of the association of some people I used to know and I don't want to know anymore. It's just because, I mean, because you and I and Matt and Camille, we've been talking about this stuff for a long time. I mean, I did your podcast when you were doing them live at a bar in Williamsburg.
The precursor to Uncomfortable Conversations.
Yeah.
You did it as well,
Matt.
Well, Camille, you did it as well.
Yeah, we were sort of talking about that stuff like in, was that probably 2015 or something?
Yeah.
So it's been a long time in the beat of talking about this stuff, but it's just like some of the people who have, you know, monetized it.
It's monomania is almost never your friend. And you see this all over politics. You actually see it in something we'll probably talk about later on in immigration, because that's such a, it's like woke stuff can be, if you really squint hard enough, it can be your explanation for everything.
Yeah.
It's big enough.
Absolutely.
You can call it, I mean, what's Wesley Yang calls it, the successor ideology, that suddenly looks a lot bigger than when you say this. Oh boy, that's, you know, you can get that into cultural Marxism. You can start using it to explain things. Immigration, you can use that too. And that monomania can go on many sides of many different issues. But as soon as you find yourself being that person, the chances of you just like being ever on alert, having your Google alerts be all about that, you're going to see, it's a big fucking country, it's a big fucking world. Yeah. You're going to see evidence to support your theory every day.
Also,
and you're going to lose.
Can we also just stipulate that if your theory is that canceling people for their beliefs or for being outspoken about certain issues is wrong, at least be consistent? Like, what kind of gets me is that people who will howl the loudest about cancel culture on the left, then somebody will come out, you know, who's an anti-Zionist and makes a pro-Palestinian point, and they'll be like, oh, thank goodness they lost their job. That was beyond the pale. Well, no, hang on. I'm going to be consistent.
Can you be consistent when you say, yeah, that's wrong, but it is hilarious? Because I don't think it's the right thing, but sometimes I do think it's kind of funny because I look at the people shrieking at the top of their lungs. And from my perspective, I'm just always thinking about what my employer or potential employer might think. I mean, it's a calculation you make in life. And these people are like on the streets, like, you know, the Jews eat the babies. I'm like, I don't know if you're going to get the job at the really big law firm doing that. So maybe that is kind of hilarious that this happens anyway.
Yeah, and some people have certain types of jobs. You don't necessarily want a public school teacher to be doing the Jews eat the babies stuff. Yeah,
no, and you also don't necessarily want a public radio broadcaster to wrestle with the kinds of ideas that I want to wrestle with. So it's not like I was unjustly maligned by my employer in some way. The
but
public
you don't,
broadcaster
but you don't frame
is a treasure in Australia, and we just parted ways because I'm up to a different thing.
Yeah, I mean, you don't frame yourself as a victim in this.
Not at all. Yeah, not at all. Yeah, I mean,
this was a smart decision.
I've never felt more liberated.
This might be your Sean Gillis moment.
Yeah. Shoulders.
Yeah.
But why shouldn't it be the case that someone who is working at a public broadcaster is engaged in thoughtful conversations about complicated issues and promoting nuance, for example? That seems like exactly the role that I would want a public broadcaster to play, to the extent there's going to be a public broadcaster at all. Like, if you can't have a place in an institution like that, it should probably be abolished.
Yeah, yeah, but like, I mean, it should be abolished anyways.
That's not my opinion.
But yeah, I mean, I don't have an Australian answer to that.
I think a serious accent.
Said it was a homosexual neo-Marxist organization.
Regardless of the public-private distinction, Camille, one answer to your question is that we've seen that happen. Just on just about every private media company as well. I mean, the aforementioned, at this point, dozen people that we had on this program who've lost their jobs, sometimes at places that they founded, like Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept, like Matt Taibbi, sure. He didn't found Rolling Stone, but he was shown the door. Ben Dreyfuss.
Gavin McGinnis.
Gavin McGinnis. We haven't had him on the program, I don't think.
No, we haven't.
Not yet. Not yet. That's going to be the grand return.
I'm open to it. I don't care.
A series of people became Jesse Singel in his own way was squeezed out of a respectable opinion. He's been kind of squeezed back in. Barry Weiss, The New York Times, over and over and over again, those places have shrank. And only a few of them have kind of re-expanded a little bit as the pendulum has swung back. So that's the problem with that. I totally agree, Camille. You should have that if you're going to have a public broadcast service. And you should have that if you're a private place, too. But the mores and culture around journalism and discussion have absolutely constricted.
And it's all you need to know about the cultures of these places is that when you see somebody like Barry Weiss, and I occasionally do work for Barry. I don't work for Barry, but I occasionally do things for her. So, I mean, but, you know, I don't have to make that announcement. I've known her and she's been on this, you know, for over a decade and she's been on this podcast a lot. But the response to her, just the invocation of her name, and the responses that you see on Twitter, people from the sort of mainstream, is fully insane. And you realize that these are people that do want to enforce a strict code of ideological conduct within their organization. You see the multiple pieces, the Adam Rubinstein piece. What was the other one in the 1841 or the Economist magazine?
Yeah.
What's his name? Bennett. James Bennett. But, you know, one other thing, and I'm going to post this. I sent this to you guys. I made a video. Which I just laid out because there was no other way of doing it. Laid out on a timeline in a video and exported it. And as I said to Matt, the default when you're making these videos in Adobe Premiere is to make every still image 5 seconds, right? 5 seconds, not that much. And it made the video about 8 minutes long. So I had to shrink it down so it's flashing on the screen. And this is the boredom of a certain type of content, whether it's talking about wokeness ad infinitum. It's like you have to think of your readers, your listeners, your viewers, don't overwhelm them with stuff. People get incredibly bored by it. And the version that I did was the screenshots that I made and put in a folder in January of 2022, I was on the train to DC on going to, on a shoot for Vice, and I was on the website, the Vice News website, and I was like, there are literally 7 stories on the homepage right now about QAnon. So I was like, this is constant. So I went back and I just captured every, not stories that were about it, but didn't mention the headline. It had to be in the headline, the word QAnon. And there were, I think, a 250, something. It was an insane number. And I was like, who are they talking to? Mm. Who is the person that is the audience for this unbelievable, just blizzard of stories about this marginal group that you want to be important? Because also, it's a very easy kind of moral position to take. Because they're really, really insane.
And I mean, this is one of the reasons why I'm relieved to get out of the 24-hour news cycle as well. Because there are so many things that we should be focusing on that are not QAnon that are actually really interesting. And I mean, it's funny you mentioned Barry Weiss. I had her on my show the week after my job disappeared.
Yeah, that was clever of you, wasn't it?
So you should go back and listen to that episode of Uncomfortable Conversations, which I sort of start by saying, so being forced out of a news organization for having unusual or controversial ideas, that's not something that you could just feel anything, any affinity with Barry. And you know, having conversations I don't want to just have conversations with the Barry Weisses and Andrew Sullivans and Matt Taibbis of the world. I also want to have a conversation, as I did, with the former president of Estonia about Putin, or, you know, with the head of the leading...
No, definitely not.
You know, the leading artificial intelligence researcher in Australia and things like that. And that's stuff that you don't get on the clickbait. And you know, there is a problem here of... And Camille, to your point about shouldn't a public broadcaster do that, it depends what arm of the public broadcaster you're talking about. I think the news arm, which happens to not be the arm that I was working in, but nonetheless, should not allow the wrestling with big ideas. The news arm should be journalism and facts and, like, no opinion whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And then there should be a firewall between that and, like, the publisher, and a firewall between that and what we would call content, which is the division that I was working in, where there should be a certain, I don't know, appreciation for the general rambunctiousness of human thought and, like, a capacious understanding of the kinds of conversations that we should have. And it shouldn't get caught in groupthink and in echo chambers. And that would be the distinction.
And this is the case, particularly with NPR, as more voices, you know, get into these media institutions that typically were kind of monocultures, political monocultures, that firewall gets smaller and smaller. It gets lower and lower. I mean, it becomes like NPR has become more ideologically obvious about where it, you know, where it, you know.
As has just about every newspaper that still exists in this country, which is dwindling by the second.
I mean, the Times is getting better. I actually think the ABC in Australia is getting better as well. Yeah. I mean, there's also this weird thing that's happening, which has been pointed out by a great journalist in Australia who was courageous for even saying this, which he was talking about in the context of Israel and Gaza, that there is something of a conflict between the push for diversity and the quest for objectivity. Because the push for diversity has as its ethos that we all bring our whole selves to our reporting, and our own lived experience informs us. And so, you know, if you're a, you know, an Arab woman who is reporting on Israel and Gaza, you're bringing something important about your own experience to the table. That is in stark contrast to the idea of there being an objective newsroom which just relies on facts and tries to strip your personality out of its reporting. So we have to find a way to, if we're going to diversify, and I agree, I don't want newsrooms to look the way that they did in the 1950s, then we have to find a way of meshing the, like, bring your own experience into your work biased.
Yeah. But this is an old conversation that we've been having on this podcast, I think, really since its inception. This notion of kind of objectivity and viewpoint diversity, and what's important to always clarify. And I know you know this, Josh, so I'm interested in how you might refine your remarks. But you always bring yourself to your work. There is always a subjective accounting of what's happening here. There is no such thing as a truly objective point of view. And while a newsroom can strive to give you something like objectivity, like, there's something about a community of journalists who begin to believe that they have the capital T truth, and their obligation is to bring you the capital T truth, and a readership or a public that thinks, I just want the objective facts here, when the best you can actually hope for is nuanced, reflective, reporting on complicated topics that invites questions and acknowledges its own biases in meaningful ways.
Yes,
and I think those are two very different projects in an important respect. And I don't think that most people who actually follow the news closely, who say things like objective journalism, actually have an appreciation for that. And I'm also reminded when you said the Times is doing better of this piece that was floating around from, who was it, Oliver Darcy at CNN, who in his newsletter was mentioning the brouhaha over the New York Times coverage of Joe Biden and the fact that they happen to acknowledge the fact that he's really, really old, obviously slowing down. And this is somehow actually the fact that they're asking the question, according to reporting of Oliver Darcy and the perspectives of their critics, the fact that they ask the question is evidence of their bias.
I mean, I would say that all of that is true, and yet you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, because actually the idea that there's no such thing as objective truth and we're all biased in some way is kind of the calling card of the diversity, equity, and inclusion crowd, who say we shouldn't strive to erase our own biases because everything is subjective. It's a very kind of post-structuralist, like 20th century French philosophy, Foucauldian idea about the world, that there's no objective truth. You're pointing to a fact, which is that none of us can escape our own minds and our own histories. But there are processes that you can put in place and frames of mind that you can put in place that will turn the dial down on that. So, I mean, I did Sam Harris's podcast recently with Jonathan Rauch from The Atlantic, and Jonathan's written a book about this, about the kind of the ways that you can take information into the funnel of journalism, not just journalism, but also institutions like public policy and so on. And there are these ratchets that will weed out the bad and enhance the good. Like, for example, having a good editor who requires you to have three sources for a story. Now, this is something that Mike Cernovich doesn't have. You know, he just goes out and just talks. You know, so a newsroom is a place where, yes, it's silly to deny that we have, you know, priors coming in, but you use systems to try to turn the volume down rather than simply turning the volume up and going, well, hey, this is all part of my lived experience, so whatever.
Yeah, agreed. I think it's something, to basically both of you say, what Camille is saying, and I, you know, I hear this a lot, about we all have our own biases. And I think you're right that there is, you know, a different version of that in the kind of DEI lexicon, that people use that quite a bit. But there is a way of doing it where you don't, because I used to work with people who didn't care about this because the institution itself kind of generally agreed with what they agreed with. So they'd make no effort.
Right.
The effort is I would sit across from people that I agreed with and I can grill them. I can take the other side, because that's not about me. I am this ancillary to the story. I am trying to get the person to say something interesting for the viewers, to challenge their assumptions that I might agree with. And yes, I have my own biases. And yes, there's story selection bias and things like that, that you have to consider all of that. And look, and by the way, sourcing, I mean, we had John on this, Rauch on this podcast and his, when he was promoting Constitution of Knowledge, I think is the new book. And we got into it with him. And it was funny because we all really love Jonathan, and particularly his
Kindly Inquisitor's
book. Kindly was his first book, I think. Kindly was an absolute masterpiece.
It's a landmark.
And, you know, there's a lot.
He was really the first on the scene with the cancel culture. 100%. And then Peter Thiel, actually, my new boss.
Weirdly, yes. And I don't say weirdly because he's your new boss. Actually, that is weird, too. But
he's weird. But, just
say that. Peter, Speaking of homosexual workplaces, forget the ABC. How's Peter been going, Camille?
Let me tell you about the interview process.
It's, by the way, this is when editing this, when Camille says something and it's not a video podcast, he's like, Camille is actually black no matter what he says. And Josh saying that, I'm like, Josh is himself an homosexual.
you can say these things.
That's great.
But even in that, when he's talking about the three sources, if you have been around journalism long enough, you also understand that those three sources are oftentimes one source. So one person says something, tells two other people in government, now you have three sources, but they're coming from the same place.
Unnamed source, too.
Unnamed source is difficult,
close,
et cetera.
Source.
This was a big deal with the yellow cake uranium thing.
Correct.
Remember during the Iraq War,
absolutely,
when Cheney basically leaked it to a bunch of people and then told reporters to talk to all of those people to get the same bullshit.
And it was all
times.
Michael Ledeen, I guess, at the end of the day, right? Wasn't that right? But that stuff is that, you know, yes, I mean, there are those safeguards traditionally in journalism. Yes, they are often ignored and people leap to the conclusions that they want to leap to. I mean, recently, we don't know exactly what happened in this aid convoy in Israel, where a bunch of people were killed, were they run over, were they shot by the Israelis. It seems like some combination of the two. I mean, the initial Hamas response was that it was an airstrike on them. And a bunch of people went with that, you know? And then there was the hospital stuff. A bunch of people went with that. Do I think that they're bad faith? Sometimes. Do I think that they're acting under time constraints and pressure in a 24-hour news cycle? That's also true. I
mean, who are the degradation people, of standards, too.
Who are the people who are going with that? I mean, there was one example I can think of where the New York Times got it wrong initially in the early days where there was a strike on a hospital and they were too quick to take Hamas's point of view. But I would say that institutions like the New York Times and the Australian Broadcasting Corporation and the British Broadcasting Corporation are generally good at not repeating those things and trying to dig into it and get to the bottom of stuff.
I mean, in fairness to
and so is the Australian, which Gerard Henderson works for, and so are the big, you know, flagship newspapers. Well, they do try to get it right.
There's a market mechanism here, obviously. I mean, they don't want to be the people that are wrong about this stuff all the time, and they don't want to seem like people that are just on one side. Obviously, they did their own investigation. Now, I think they handled it horribly at the beginning, and I think they were too credulous and too quick to say, well, obviously, it's a good story. They told us this is what happened, and this is what we're expecting to happen. Your expectations are the confirmation bias in some ways. You expect there to be this many people in a hospital, et cetera. But yeah, they're going to correct themselves, and they did their own investigation. Washington Post did an investigation. The tunnel stuff at Al-Shifa Hospital, people did people do want to get this stuff right. Unfortunately, there's a lot of people within organizations, and you see in the New York Times this story about the Daily podcast about rapes and Hamas rapes, which is amazing to me. All these people find it, they're absolutely incredulous that the people of Hamas would rape somebody. We need to get the facts on that. Well, you do.
Why would
need
a freedom fighter rape anybody? It doesn't make any sense.
You need to get the facts on that. But that said, I think that there is people internally in places like that who are, and there's definitely an age difference. And I pointed this out before. Matt and Camille and I talked about this when Camille signed the Harper's letter, the free speech kind of thing, which, you know, Salman Rushdie was on, Noam Chomsky, et cetera. Ideologically, it was all over the map. But the difference was, and I asked, so I wonder what this was. And a listener of ours, our brilliant listeners, did the laborious work of aggregating the ages of the people who did the response letter to Harper's and saying, no, we don't want this at all. And the average age was like 30 versus the Harper's letter, which was like 65 or 60 or something. Only, I mean, brought
Camille
down
does
by Camille.
Look really good for a 65-year-old.
It does not. It doesn't crack. It doesn't crack. Unless you smoke it.
I mean, I would say just to wrap up, to tie this up in a bow, is I don't want to be the guy who leaves mainstream media and then shits all over mainstream media and tries to erode trust in mainstream media. I think it's indispensable. I think the work that the big institutions are doing is irreplaceable. I don't think a bunch of podcasters like us can, you know, are an alternative to the mainstream media.
Yes, that's what we do.
The ABC is a national treasure. Much of the Murdoch press even is important in all of the investigative journalism 100%, that it does. Yeah. You know, I want to have different kinds of conversations. I want to wrestle with bigger things. It wasn't a perfect fit, but I don't want to go on like some Piers Morgan victory lap where I'm like, oh, I'm being canceled and silenced because they're all corrupt. That's not what's happening here.
Yeah. I mean, and also it is when somebody, you talked about Barry Weiss, she gave a talk at the 92nd Street Y, and it was like a private talk. You couldn't buy publicly tickets for obvious reasons.
This is New York City.
It's in New York City. And of course, what happens is the place is surrounded by people. The police are like getting in fights with quote unquote protesters. It's like they don't want these people to even say anything at all about anything. And it reminded me when I was younger and I went to England, and it was before the newspaper culture was replaced by the internet, and the joy that I got in the morning going to the news agent in buying the Telegraph, the Times, the Guardian, and the Independent.
I'm sorry, you left out the world's greatest newspaper.
The Sun?
The Daily Mail.
The Daily Mail. Yeah. Well, I saw too, it was too much of a little Englander tabloid. I liked the real uncut right-wing tabloid, which was either the Sun or the News of the World. So I'd buy that, and the Mirror was the left-wing one. And I'd buy all of them, and it was really fun to read all this stuff. And I don't know why we've gotten to this place, I do in some ways, to a culture where people are like, that person is speaking here, we must stop them from saying anything. And that's something we've talked about in this podcast for 8 years, probably. And it's never, I can't resolve it in my head at this point still.
RIP Page Three Girls.
Yeah, oh my God, the best.
I mean, you do need to be taught, don't you, about the importance of and the value for everybody in tolerating a maximally large number of different ideas. I think it's instinctively, it feels right to think like, well, okay, Josh Sepps is bringing Douglas Murray to Australia for a live tour. Why would we tolerate hate Mm-hmm. But why would we tolerate hate?
So you know, much
we should
hate.
Petition.
I call
too
it
much gay on stage. Yeah. But you know, I can understand that if you're in such an echo chamber, driven partly by the fragmentation of media, driven partly by the fragmentation of our societies as they sort demographically, and driven in large part by algorithms that kind of, you know, feed you stuff that reinforces what you already think and that demonizes what you don't already think, then you are going to have a tendency to think, I mean, I'm on the right side of history. Why do people have to keep puncturing this bubble? And like, why wouldn't you just stand up for what is good? Why do all these troublesome people have to keep talking with their bullshit? Like, you do have
No one thinks they're on the wrong side of history.
Well, exactly. But you have to be taught that. Like, you do have to learn a little bit about John Stuart Mill. Like, you do have to learn a little bit about how the Enlightenment
and not just John Stuart.
How the Enlightenment, you know, gave us all of the stuff that we appreciate today precisely because it permitted the largest possible number of ideas to be circulated.
Why didn't you bring me to Australia?
Yeah, good question.
That's a good idea.
Is it because I'm not
I want to go.
A member of your club?
I mean,
your lavender club.
John, I'll come. I want to be very clear. I'll come for free. All you gotta do is fly me first class.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. That's not
that's
for free.
Not exactly. It's free, Camille.
To Australia.
I'm just going
to
be honest. I will fly coach and give everybody a hand job. Yeah. I don't care. I've never been there.
It's so the old lady sitting next
He's
to
always
you.
Always undercutting me. This is always undercutting
me. They call me Pumps
Moynihan. And it's the dumping of hand jobs that actually does it. Jeez.
This is the shit that I forget to cut out.
Yeah.
Maybe I won't. I don't know.
It's fine. Right.
And then people take you up on the offer.
Yeah.
I love that you just talked to Roush, because Roush is like one of the people who really helped crystallize for me. Now that I didn't have an understanding of it before, but like the arguments that are necessary for us to be making on an ongoing basis to help people understand like the really complicated mechanisms that we have for actually figuring out what is true about the world and the things that are necessary in order for it to work. And what I've always appreciated about quote unquote wokeness, that I am sure most people who describe themselves as anti-woke don't actually appreciate, is that the reason to hate it isn't because of the specific kind of aesthetic failures of the ideas on offer. Like I reject the specific like philosophical claims that are made there, like those, the value judgments in that particular system of belief about the congenital evil of people of particular backgrounds and the congenital lack of fitness of people of other backgrounds. If you are Black and you're born into a particular system, you are by definition disadvantaged. I think this is a poisonous ideology. But the actual fundamental foundational concern that I have with them is that they have a particular worldview that is at odds with the preservation of a free society. Mm. Like from their standpoint, the appropriate way to decide truth is effectively to invoke this radical egalitarian principle, which is, I believe, like the way that Roush described it, like the notion that what is true about the world is something that can only be identified by the victimized in our society. They will tell us what to believe. And to the extent DEI is a problem, it's a problem because in various institutions, like they actually inculcate those kinds of beliefs. And I'm not being sensationalist when I describe it that way. The trouble is, if your perspective is, you know, I'm anti-woke and we're going to ban those bad ideas and we're going to do a number of other things to ensure that certain kinds of bad ideas like don't have any space, then you're addressing the aesthetic defects of wokeism and you're leaving undisturbed, perhaps even compounding the thing that is most threatening, that's most tyrannical about these ideologies.
And it's actually quite a hard step to take. I mean, I think it requires work on our part. Like when all of my shit was going down in Australia, it was at the same time that Israel and Gaza was going bonkers in terms of the protests in the West and a lot of protests in Australia. I mean, I would say that the median center of gravity in Australia has become extremely anti-Zionist, not just, you know, pro-Palestinian. And there were people who were colleagues of mine in the social media influencer world who were getting pretty close to anti-Semitism in the stuff that they were pumping out. Yeah. Like, it was extremely uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I was privy to conversations about how we should have letter writing campaigns to their book publishers to encourage them to sever ties or to their podcast networks to have their podcasts canceled. And the only thing I ever said was to chime in and say, don't go there, guys.
Yeah.
Don't do that. Respond to the ideas. If you think they're wrong, explain why they're wrong. Yeah. We all have a megaphone now. We all have a Twitter feed. Many of us have podcasts. Talk about the ideas. Don't attack the people. You don't want to open that Pandora's box. You do not want to live in a world where everybody is looking over their shoulder, treading on eggshells, worried about triggering tripwires because a mob might come for them and attack not their beliefs, not their arguments, but their livelihoods, their families, their well-being.
If those and meanwhile, you were obviously keeping a list of all of their
names. Yeah, I'll get to them later.
You were the Oscar Schindler of kind of a different thing. But no, I think that's exactly right. And when Camille was saying that, I was thinking the same thing, is that this stuff isn't easy. It's, I mean, these kind of ideological battles, and if you care about this stuff, it's not an easy position to take because there is a very distinctly authoritarian in almost sometimes totalitarian bent to these ideologies that we talk about, because, you know, I don't want people to be in the situation that I was in for 5 years in my job, which was as it got worse and worse and worse, and it got really bad around 2019, 20, around then, to express a different opinion was to basically sideline yourself. You know, they wouldn't fire you, they would pay you, which was, you know, an amazing thing for
Sounds
me, which
fine.
They did, and just didn't put me on certain projects, and by which certain, I mean any, certain and any sometimes blur. But that is a very difficult position to take when you don't want anybody else to be in that situation if the situation is reversed. The totalitarian instinct must be treated in that kind of ecumenical way and say, you know what? You know, in the Cold War, it wasn't like, oh God, these people, these commies, these Marxists, these Reds. The times that are criticized in the response, the anti-communist response, which really interestingly was the left, the extreme left in America, did such a great job selling as the only response, so much so that a liberal historian named Richard Gid Powers wrote a book in the 90s called Not Without Honor, and it was a book about the anti-communist movement. Not Without Honor was the book about anti-communism, not about communism.
That's
and
crazy.
It's like, you know, the excesses of McCarthyism, the excesses of blacklist, et cetera. And that was actually a response. I mean, particularly in Hollywood, the blacklist was a response to a communist blacklist. So communist writers would try desperately to get people like Rex Harrison, people who were like, you know, more right of, they would make sure that they didn't work. I mean, the union itself was that. So Reagan took over the union. That was a blacklist responding to a blacklist. And then, of course, the legacy is only one blacklist. But the instinct to do that is completely natural. I totally understand.
Look at the Christian right. Look at the Christian conservatives. Look at the, you know, I mean, you know, Monty Python's Life of Brian was trying to be canceled back in the 70s by religious conservatives. It's not like the left came up with cancel culture. No. The left has just co-opted it in the past couple,
and they're just better at it. They're better at it because the broader institutions are either on their side, or if they're not on their side, they know not to say anything.
Right, but my fear is that the more that we push back and attack that boogeyman and become paranoid ourselves, the more likely it is that there'll be a right-wing cancel culture.
Correct.
You know, which will become emboldened
as well. I would say one final thing. There is one.
Oh, there is.
That's true. And it's one small brief thing about this, is that all people can, if you've worked in this business, even if you haven't, you can imagine this. You're not going to be a person at the New York Times who, after the Louis story comes out, and there's a bunch of editorials that people write Louis and the sort of, you know, horrible culture of you know, comedy or something. And they had, you know, Noam, our friend Noam Dorman on the Daily podcast talking about it. Two episodes of it. I don't think I've ever heard another one, two episodes about Louis. You're not going to be the person at the New York Times in the editorial meeting who says, like, literally no one's going to do this, and says, it's kind of bullshit, but they will email us. They will definitely send us DMs, but that is ultimately the problem of it, is the culture. You don't want to produce that culture or produce the opposite culture when your ideology is the one that's reigning. So,
Camille, let's put you on the spot, right? So you talk all these highfalutin words that got like compound syllables and such. Florida, the university system, for what I understand, just like axed a whole bunch of DEI departments. Good or bad?
Well, actually, I've only tracked that so closely, so I'm going to be somewhat restrained in what I have to say right this moment because the details matter. But I can say, because I've been tracking this thing more broadly, that there are plenty of instances where universities, especially public funded universities, have DEI programs that run afoul of the principle of free speech and likely the First Amendment. So certainly these kind of pledges that various universities demand from people where they have to insist that they are going to pursue their research in a way that is consistent with a particular ideology.
And statements
are wrong. The question of whether or not the various universities ought to be funding DEI programs in general, I think is another thing entirely. But I think the issue in more broadly for people who want to try and regulate this sort of conduct is that oftentimes they craft the legislation in such a way that they're only going after particular bad ideas, these divisive concepts bills, like the Stop Woke Act, which was just lost in the 11th Circuit,
I believe
this week.
Which is Georgia, conservative Alabama, court. Florida. It's a pretty conservative circuit.
Yeah. And the Stop Woke Act, in addition to regulating this kind of conduct on universities and in public education, was also interested in regulating this kind of conduct amongst private employers, which is a place where it really, really, really ran afoul of the Constitution. So it is entirely possible, and I'll summarize in this way. It's entirely possible that our concerns about free expression and our concerns about legitimate bad things like formal discrimination on the part of governments or employers come into some conflict at some point, entirely possible. And the very difficult work of trying to understand where the appropriate places are to draw the lines is something that we can approach in a thoughtful and curious way, where we're actually trying to seek out the edges and make prudent decisions about what's happening, or we could just try to blow everything the fuck up. And by so doing, run the risk of blowing ourselves up too, or prized institutions that are important for this work of knowledge formation. And I think far too many people are inclined towards, we have to do something, anything, because we're facing an existential threat. And that do something, anything is seize power, dictate to other people precisely what the right thing is to do. And I think that approach is not just wrong, as the 11th Circuit and their rather interesting and very accessible decision lay out, it's unconstitutional, illiberal, and something to be avoided by any serious person who actually cares about what makes the particular country that we live in great, that makes the West great, and that makes the whole process of truth formation that's led to the prosperity that we all enjoy possible. Like, if you care about those things, then you have to oppose people who are disregarding it in service of trying to defeat their enemies and win easy, cheap, and cheap because they're so quickly and thoroughly overturned political battles.
You might have run afoul of DEI regulations at any of the universities when you said, why the West is great. Which I don't know if you're allowed to say anymore. Yeah. Josh Sapps, eliminating DEI programs in Florida and in public universities.
Well, I mean, I don't quite understand why the government is the right tool for this particular job. I mean, I'm not close to this issue. It strikes me that the correct reform would be to reform university administrations if you feel that syllabuses have gotten crazy. Mm. I mean, it's less about the syllabus, right? And it's more about
actual departments at state universities that are...
Well, that's why the government's involved. State operated, state funded.
Right, but the government wouldn't ordinarily be taking a granular approach to specific behaviors like that.
Usually not.
I mean, I would make the case that I think that this, the Stop Woke Act was absurd in about 1,000 levels, and the court was right in the decision, and what I read about the decision from the decision, I thought was, you know, pretty much what I thought. Eliminating the DEI departments, I'm not upset about. I think it's fine. And the reason I think it's fine is that if it is about, on the top level, and this is how it's always presented, that representation, that flabby word that everyone throws around that essentially means nothing these days, because representation, he's like, is it 13% of the population? It's like, well, no, it never stops. I mean, it's like, if you can get 80%, you're the happiest person in the world. It's no longer representation. But if that's what it's about, That's what admissions is for. And we have those battles in the Supreme Court over the Bakke decision, over affirmative action, et cetera. And we can solve that there. DEI is an explicitly ideological department, arm of the university, whatever you want to call it. If there were a version of this that was promoting the views of Moms for Liberty in a kind of sort of more adult sense, because they talk about elementary school education, junior high stuff, I don't think we'd even have a second thought about this. If there was a department within the university saying one must talk about America in a particular way, in a patriotic way, in a way that admires the founders, admires the Constitution.
Have to issue a statement as you're getting your job.
That you think the Constitution is the greatest thing.
Well, for me, that's the thing. For me, the thing is forcing people to sign statements. Like, it is absolutely anathema to media. Yes. And it's, the point has been well made by others that, you know, the ability to write an essay about how your, if you're a, you know, a professor who's applying for a job at a university, the ability to write an application essay about how your career at that university is going to enhance diversity at the institution is something that is going to come naturally to a certain class of well-educated, upper-middle-class white person.
That's right.
And may not come as naturally to a Bangladeshi professor who hasn't been inculcated in this, who's coming in and trying to get a job. So it may actually not...
I'm a scientist. What are you talking
about? Exactly. That's right. I'm great with particle physics. What do you want from me?
I don't understand. Could you imagine asking Leo Szilard if he's coming to Los Alamos, like, how are you going to... He's like, I don't know. We're all European Jews. Right. And we got kicked out.
Yeah.
Or like, and we're going to make an atomic bomb, so could you please fuck off?
Imagine Slavo Žižek trying to explain to somebody how he's going to incorporate, you know, diversity values. So for me, you know, expecting people to talk a certain kind of elitist university educated language and then requiring them to sign their fealty to a set of ideological positions is completely absurd. And I would definitely get rid of that through whatever means necessary. But at heart, I'm an incrementalist. So if you could do that by reforming the department rather than passing laws that abolish it, I would.
There's a certain amount of this that you know, sort of democracy, freedom, the West will use its own tools to destroy itself. I mean, that's kind of the thing is, you know, the Lenin quote is that, you know, the capitalists will sell you the rope that you hang them with. And this is essentially an amount of that here. And this is the thing with the RUFO types. And I think they're on very dangerous ground here that, okay, they want to destroy the institution. So we have to use these kind of extrajudicial ways of saving the institutions, which I don't think is necessary. But that said, I think that the DEI stuff is so, I mean, we're talking about an acronym and people are having conversations on cable news about this acronym. Tell me what University of Florida, what this department is requiring of people. And I think that once you kind of enumerate those things, people are like, oh yeah, that's fucking insane. Why would, that's great. A university is telling people what they have to say and they have to express fealty to this idea or this person and diversity, because whatever it is, if it's diversity, like that word is so wonderfully chosen, because who could be opposed to that? Who opposes diverse? And then people say, well, let's talk, like, you don't mean diverse viewpoints. No, stop talking.
Define your terms.
Diversity is an amazing thing. So therefore, you have to, how are you going to enhance this? You should be able to have a job as a physicist, as a professor of even literature, if you say, I will do absolutely nothing to further diversity. I will teach people about literature. And I will do it from maybe different, but I was hired to do American literature. There are Black people in American literature. There are Native Americans in American literature. I just do good literature. You know, I mean, the old Saul Bellow quote, show me the Proust of the Papuans and I'll read him. I don't care. I just care about good literature. But what they're demanding is that there's a layer above that of whether you care about good literature. It's like, well, what about the idea of literature, the ideology of the whole thing? It doesn't have an ideology. It shouldn't have an ideology. You should read Upton Sinclair, despite the fact that he politically was a complete fucking dingbat on every possible issue. And you should read, I don't know, Evelyn Waugh, who was one of the few writers in Writers Take Sides in 1936 that said, I support Franco. Great. Who fucking cares? Because, you know... Every one of his books is fantastic. I don't give a shit what he thinks. But that these things make sure that you don't have that.
I, too, support James Franco. I think he's done some really important work.
I prefer Dave.
Actually, actually, James Franco is a non-entity in Hollywood now.
That's true.
So. On the diversity issue, just lastly, I was catching up with Coleman Hughes. And by the way, people should see this. It's not on YouTube yet, but if you're listening to my podcast, we also now have a YouTube page, so you should go and subscribe, because I have like an embarrassingly small number of subscribers on YouTube because we just launched it.
Yeah,
so everyone go and subscribe. I think if you search for Uncomfortable Conversations on YouTube, you get something called Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man.
And yes,
you don't know about this guy?
Stop. No.
Wait, it's Uncomfortable Conversations and you saying with a Black Man, or is that the name of it?
That's the name.
Oh, okay.
That's another show.
I was excited about that racism
There's another. There's some other show
Australian right now.
Stolen my name.
Hey, Gerard. Black Man, no, not at all.
So you have to search Zepps YouTube. S-Z-E-P-S.
We'll link it in the show notes.
Anyway, so Coleman Hughes and Jesse Single and I went up to Columbia the other day with a videographer.
This is a joke.
A black guy and an Aussie walk in a Columbia University. and I also caught up with Thomas Chatterton Williams, who was fabulous, at Grant's Tomb, of all places. Shot a conversation there. But Coleman was talking about diversity. You wouldn't believe this. Coleman talking about diversity?
No, I don't buy it.
And one of the points that came up was, I have literally worked in workplaces where if you're putting together people on a media panel, then, or even just inviting guests on a television show or a radio show, the producer is obliged to fill out a diversity spreadsheet so that the organization can track its diversity targets, its metrics.
Yeah. Yes.
Which means that they write the race, they write the sex, they write the sexuality, guessing.
Yeah.
I guess. Intrusive? I mean, they're not
depends
asking.
Depends on
people.
How many beers they hold. What column is that?
And what's
that's
amazing
what the couch is for in the green room.
What's amazing? You're got to find it out.
If I'm with two girls and they're hooking up, does that mean I'm gay?
I don't know. Let's find out.
Involved.
Camille's going to run the experiment.
Camille, I've been trying to find that out for the past year.
Welcome in the girls, ladies and gentlemen. It's like Cherie and
it's like the old Howard Stern show.
My point is simply that there is no column on that spreadsheet for ideology. There is no column on that spreadsheet for political outlook. There is no column on that spreadsheet for economic background or class. So you're selecting for a very limited set of metrics.
My former employer used to release every year a vast amount of statistics about how many people of different backgrounds were doing X, Y, and Z in the company. It was meticulous detail, and it was very scary. It reminded me of the detail kept by authoritarian regimes on, dissidents and people of the wrong ethnic background. But it was insane to see the deal, and they released this publicly. It wasn't.
And yet, what you can end up with is you might have a television panel where there is a Sikh woman, an indigenous woman, a transgender woman, and like an African woman. And they're all saying the same fucking thing.
They all agree violently.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
One thing that's that I think is underrated in the conversations about this is that we are about ready, I think, over the next 5 years to basically make illegal most forms of state mandated affirmative action in the United States.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court is listing in that direction. There's been a lot of work for that. Affirmative action has just never been popular, which is something that almost never gets discussed, including among the
black voters too,
people who are supposed to intended to help. So that's going away. And so we've already seen in the places where that has been applied, like public schools, for example, universities in California, really imaginative workarounds to it. And
what was the Harvard one? The Asian personality test?
Yeah, the personality test.
Which is itself deeply racist, right?
It's super duper racist. One of the workarounds that they use, for instance, in K-12, including the New York City system, is that they use economic class basically as a stand-in, as a predictor that if you are below the poverty line or below some multiple above the poverty line, that you're probably black or brown is the idea in New York. It differs in different places. It's fascinating because I think a lot of the efforts to kind of push up DEI and push up those kind of structures come from the managerial and largely white progressive class who find a way in all of this because they can speak the language of it, to your point earlier, they're going to be grandfathered in. Like, even if they have to, like, self-denunciation, yeah. whatever.
You never lose your own job.
Yeah. You never lose your own job. You can sort of, like, figure it out. You've created a new rule. You have to kind of, like, go through this minefield, as Greg Lukianoff from FIRE has pointed out in the past. But if they really do replace these things with a class analysis and enforce that rigorously, it's going to look way different than that.
Way different. I mean, it's funny because to your point, I was looking at one of these DEI reports from Vice and it was like new hires. It was like 60% of people of color, which by the way is, you know, that's, I guess, overrepresentation. And the executives, when you went to the bottom, was still like 90% white. And they're the ones who are creating this entire thing. But the funny thing about this is, I don't know if you saw this video, and it'd be hard to find, I don't know how to search it, but it was about a week ago that I saw it on Twitter, and it was some woman from, I think, UVA, so maybe it wouldn't be that hard to find, talking to a graduate student or something, and it was just like a Zoom video, and she was introducing this woman about her, you know, this woman who's really understood. I mean, it was like a re-education video. And it's like, you know, she's understood her privilege and she's been great in speaking about her whiteness and the evil of whiteness. And it comes back to this woman, which I don't even think the people who posted this were posting it for this reason. But her first response was so unbelievable. She was like, yes, this is all true. And, you know, it's not something I understood growing up in Appalachia. No joke.
I'm sorry, what? No.
The entire thing was about privilege and about whiteness. And she was like, you know, growing up in Appalachia, I didn't, you know, I had friends that were, I didn't understand any of this stuff.
I mean, I guess someone has to own a coal mining company.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's the guy who talked about Cocaine Mitch, but anyway, crazy. Camille, should we look at this video?
Play one of these clips. We don't have all day with
yeah,
we
had Johnny. Yeah.
I was just trying to see if I could Jen find the clip that you were referring to.
Oh, that's amazing.
I'll see if I can find
Speaking of West Virginia, actually.
Is she from West Virginia?
No, but the clip.
Oh, yeah, this is incredible. Talk about class politics. This is a great version of it. This is from last night.
So we're transitioning to yeah, Super Tuesday results were coming in. It's an MSNBC panel, and it was profoundly diverse.
They're increasingly, from the Tea Party on, they're voting on race. They're voting on this idea of an invasion of brown people over the border. The idea that they can't get whatever job they want. A black person got it. Therefore, drive all the blacks out of the colleges. Get rid of DEI. That is what they're voting on. They're just voting specifically on racial animus. At this stage, it isn't about economics.
No, which is why Trump killed the immigration bill.
Correct.
That's why. And because otherwise, he can't run against the other and brown people and people who don't look like him, like his supporters, his base of supporters coming across the border and scaring people and killing people or whatever he's threatening out there. I mean, if you look at some of these exit polls, I mean, I live in Virginia. Immigration was the number one issue. Yeah. I mean, again, these could change in Virginia.
Well, Virginia does have a border with West Virginia. Very contested area.
Build the wall. Like, what? I mean, when I was in New Hampshire, people were talking about the northern border as a threat. Because Trump has indoctrinated people with this fear of people who do not look like them being a threat to them.
But as you know, I mean, and every election cycle, particularly when there's a Democratic incumbent, we get reminded about the borders. And the borders become a thing again. And then if there's a Republican in office, we don't think about them anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's the deficit and the border. Like you make these things an issue. You make them into boogeymen. You make them into something that grabs you from under the bed at night as soon as you wake up. As long as there's a Democratic incumbent to blame on it, you make sure that nothing's ever done to fix either. And then you hope that people stop talking about them once you've got a Republican
in
office.
But the Republican,
it's just the same thing my entire adult life.
But the only difference now is they dropped the every 4 years part. And now, I mean, all the programming about cities, the greatest threat of crime and
well, meanwhile, Earth One, the FBI reports that violent crime in America is at a 50-year low.
And migrant crime is not a thing.
And migrant crime is not a thing. And you live on Earth One. Yeah.
Wow.
Camille, you want to start that?
You used to live in Virginia. To get wrong there.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, as soon as you shared this clip this morning, I went to go look at the numbers with respect to like immigration in Virginia, and particularly like the undocumented population. And having recently moved out of Arlington, Virginia, and spent most of my life actually living in that part of the world,
I can tell you that there is a huge immigrant population there. Mm-hmm. And Virginia is apparently like number 14 or 13 in the country with respect to its the percentage of its population, the share of its population that happens to be undocumented Americans. And the percentages are only so different. I think it's maybe like a point away from Arizona, for example. Hmm. So why is this an issue of interest to the population of Virginia? Because they are living with the realities of it. And the trends have actually increased in recent years. Virginia has seen some outflow of population, but to the extent it's seeing growth, it's in rural communities, and it's a lot of people who are coming from other parts of the world. They are literally living with this reality every single day. And Jen Psaki may live there, but insulated, cloistered in her particular community the way that she is, doing her television show on a nightly basis, she is obviously immune from the facts of reality that are entering into people's lives. Now, whether or not every person who's voting on these issues is influenced by those practical facts versus like insane political narratives, I can't tell you just off the cuff. In fact, I suspect plenty of those people are maniacs on the left and the right, quite frankly. But I can tell you that when I see someone like Rachel Maddow joke about violent crime and how we're at a 50-year low in violent crime, it's like there is a sleight of hand there that is just like so naked.
Wait, what's the sleight of hand? Is it not true that it's a 50-year low?
It's a 50-year low, but that's useful if you want to obscure the fact that over the course of the last like 5 years, we've actually seen a meaningful increase, the kind of meaningful increase that would make lots of people concerned. I'm concerned about violent crime in my neighborhood, I'm not, and I've seen it spike by 10 or 15 or 20 or even 50%
right.
over the course of 2 or 3
years.
I wasn't alive 50 years ago. That doesn't make me feel more comfortable.
This is everywhere. It was this guy on Substack who's a criminologist who came out with these numbers, and it was all over MSNBC. There's some playing with some numbers in there. I think there's some accuracy to some of it. There's reporting issues that people point out all the time, and somebody pointed out the other day that I can't remember, it was Austin or something. Oh, these crimes are down here. But mysteriously, stolen cars are up by like 80% or 30% or something huge. And as somebody pointed out, it's like this reporting this stuff, it's self-reported. And a lot of people don't report. And cars, you have to report for insurance purposes if your car gets stolen. So you're going to have a pretty accurate number in that.
And murders.
Yeah. And there's a couple things about this that drive me crazy. First of all, it's the idea that even if Virginia was not full of immigrants, illegal, recent migrants who are legal, who are committing crimes, who aren't committing, it doesn't make a difference. There are a lot of people there, like when I very briefly lived in Northern Virginia when I was in DC, everywhere around me, like every place was like a little pupusa shop because there were tons of like, you know, Ecuadorian immigrants, Salvadorian immigrants, all over the place. So it's not strange at all, but that obscures something. And it's that even if that weren't the case, why can't you care about the borders of your country and how, you know, demographics are changing, whatever it might be? I don't know what people's concern are. I'm just sort of filling this in. But even if you live in a place where there aren't any immigrants, you can't have that as a concern. I mean, these people are on the streets talking about Gaza every day. They don't live by Gaza. Nobody would make that argument. You're not going to get blown up by Israel or blown up by a suicide bomber, et cetera.
I mean,
but it's also wrong in the sense that it's like I did a story of this woman in 2016, January of 2016. I went, Trump was speaking in Marshalltown, Iowa before the Iowa caucuses. And I went up to this place in the middle of nowhere of this woman who was supporting Trump. And she was the principal of a school where everybody was the child of an illegal immigrant because of all the hog processing plants only had people from Central America working there. And she was incredibly generous. She was incredibly sweet. She would pick these kids up at school on her own because the parents were out working at 6 a.m. and she would go pick them up, bring them to school. And they, you know, by her lights, and she was supporting Trump, didn't deserve to be there, didn't belong there. But she was just, that's in the middle of Iowa. These are people on fucking MSNBC who would say, Iowa, Jesus Christ. Like they know, yeah, every country, every place in this country knows something about immigration, whether it's New York City or Chicago or Iowa or Virginia. And even if they didn't, to have that concern is not at all crazy.
To just to steel man Rachel Maddow for a moment.
Sure.
It is a phenomenon that is real, that every time the Republicans want to beat this up, they want it to be an issue, that they didn't pass the bill because they want it to
that's
be
true.
An issue.
That's true of Trump,
that they
sure.
talk
sure.
about the deficit whenever Democrats are in power, and then also they get true. Into power and they spend like drunken sailors.
But they don't talk about the deficit mm-hmm. anymore. That's she hasn't updated her price.
They don't even that's pretend true. To
but
care.
I mean, so there is this phenomenon going on where, yes, you
it's
do have
politics,
to... You have to acknowledge the politics of it, and you have to acknowledge the media's complicity. In some of the hysteria. That being said, allow me to parachute in from a remote island nation and school you guys on immigration policy.
Tell us.
One thing that really...
We don't have walls.
Exactly. We've got a bloody moat. One thing that really irritates me about the conversation around immigration in America, and always has, and it's even happened, Camille, you just kind of did it, and Michael, you just kind of did it, which is...
Tell me.
In like the same sentence or two sentences back to back... We'll talk about immigrants and we'll talk about undocumented or illegal immigrants.
Sure, mm-hmm, sure.
As if they're the same thing.
Not what I'm saying.
No.
I know it's not what you're saying.
Yeah.
But the issue in the States has become so fucked up and the policy has become so confused that the question of people coming across, people literally just walking into the country with no apparent right to do so.
Yeah.
Has become conflated with what is the overarching strategy of this migrant nation going to be moving forward.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, my country has made a Faustian pact where it bribes small South Pacific Island nations to build concentration camps so that if anybody tries to arrive illegally by boat, which they used to do in significant numbers, there was a policy that they will never set foot in Australia, even if they're legitimate
and
refugees.
Now they don't, right?
And they don't. And they don't come anymore. So, right?
Works,
I mean, because they know, like the people smugglers know that they don't have a market anymore. Yeah. But when that policy has been softened in the past, the boats start up again. And then the Navy intercepts them before they get into Australian waters so that we're technically not in breach of the Refugee Convention. They get shipped off to some friendly country that we're bribing. And then if they are legitimate refugees, then hopefully they get repatriated to another country. But that country will never be Australia. That's the policy. At the same time, Australia is either number one or two in the world for refugee resettlement and has one of the highest immigration rates per capita in the world and has done since the end of the Second World War. And the argument by Caldwell, who was the first ever immigration minister after the Second World War, was the only way that you're going to be able to convince the Australian people to accept the levels of immigration that this country needs is by having them feel that they're in complete control. And that is the trade-off. Yeah. If you don't feel like you're in control, you get Brexit. If you don't feel like you're in control, you get Trump. There's this, like, I believe that America, like, why is it the case that if you can make it to the southern border and cross, that's great, but if you're in a refugee camp in Bangladesh, that's not so great? Like, proximity should not be the deciding factor here. So I'm always on the side, like, people think that I'm like an immigration hawk or something because I'm like, yeah, secure that border and like make sure that that's not the main conversation in immigration. Let's talk about an actual immigration policy.
Yeah,
I was a migrant here. I got a green card. Sure. I lived in New York for 12 years. It's a pain in the ass. You have to jump through lots of hoops.
Closing the door behind him. They always do it.
There are ways of doing it. I mean, figure out who you want and then pick those people.
When did your VDR column start? Was it this year? which, by the way, is run by British people that came to America. No, a couple things here. Well, first I'll start and say that why are these things conflated? They're not really conflated, but I mentioned both of them for a specific reason. The beginning of that clip is Joy Reid. And Joy Reid makes an argument that a panel of doofuses, no one decides to intercede because, I don't know, that would make good television to have people have different views. But everyone is the amen choir there. And what she's saying is that it's not about documented or undocumented. It's about race to her. She says, oh, they're brown people. They want the brown people gone. And I don't think that somebody like Joy Reid has a very narrow view of the world. And it's about 10 blocks from her house in the Upper West Side, I imagine. But if you look at anywhere in the world where you have, you know, people that are coming in, you know, the anti-immigration view, they always say flooding a neighborhood and they're white. Right. But they're from Georgia, in
Russia,
Azerbaijan. Like, people just don't like them. It's just never a thing.
Look at the UK and Polish people.
The Polish plumber, they were like actively trying to expel Polish people because, I mean, look right now.
Even the hot ones?
Well, no, I'm not making policy.
Okay.
But you know, you see the same thing now of like of the Poles. Speaking of Poles, who have been so sympathetic to the Ukrainian struggle, are now blocking the border because they don't want Ukrainian grain coming in, and nobody likes anything outside screwing up their ecosystem. So that's just like, so I mention it for that sense that when people racialize this, because Joy Reid doesn't know how to think outside of those terms. That's just not to say that they're all racist became difficult when you have 65 million people voting for Donald Trump. I mean, I was guilty of this at the beginning too. And then I went and talked to people. I don't think she's talked to anyone who lives outside of her little area and believes the same things that she believes. But also the populist thing is interesting. When you had your little Pauline Hanson moment, it's really interesting. International institutions that, well, you know, it's a violation of X international policy, refugee policy. And look, that's literally how you get Viktor Orban. That's how you get people. And you said Brexit. It's like these international institutions should not be telling me what I can do on my own borders. And that's the kind of breakdown that you see that more and more in places. I didn't know Australia had that record. And it's really interesting to know that turning back boats policy was actually successful. That's something I didn't know.
I mean, I also got to say, it's a terrible moral stain in a way. Like, I do think, but I think the moral stain is going to land somewhere along the, at some point between we live really good, rich lives and lots of other people don't, there's going to be inflection points that are nasty. And I personally think that once you have people in your duty of care, you have a better duty of care towards them than to let them rot in perpetuity in a concentration camp on a desert Pacific island.
I think it's true.
I would probably tolerate a higher level of boats coming in and I would figure out some more humane system. But I'm just saying there's a trade-off somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, it's also true in America. And sorry, Matt. It is true somewhere that you know, people that they interview in New York are here because they know that there's literally nothing that anyone can do once they get here.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing.
There's also money and jobs.
Yeah,
sure. And you need to process the people. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with people being able to declare asylum at the border, but they then need to swiftly be rebuked if it's not true. Like, there has to be a mechanism for...
Just 3 years, Swift? I have a hard time keeping track. A quick point on the Joy Reid aspect. I've watched the last couple of days like more Donald Trump than I have in the previous year, just because he's been talking a lot. He's been doing victory laps for his...
I could tell you seemed much happier in just
Supreme Court decision, smiling more. I watched him because, unlike the other guy who won a bunch of Super Tuesday contests, he actually went in front of the camera after he won and didn't just sit looking at a wall at a weird event and say, I better not answer questions because I'll get into trouble, which is just a horrifying clip if you haven't seen it.
It's awful.
It's really bad.
He keeps saying that line too.
Yeah.
And it's like,
and he's not smiling.
Yeah, but why do you think people, what are they assessing that? You're going to get in trouble because you're 1,000 years old and you're going to say something that makes no sense. That's like, why are you?
He wants to, but he's going to get into trouble. Yeah. But anyways, Trump was talking and it's remarkable the contrast between what he was saying and what Joy Reid and others were describing what he said.
Yeah.
In his remarks, take them for what they are, it's Trump and this is going to be half crazy and stuff. He's saying, you know, he was basically contrasting how life was in America during his presidency, maybe up until about February 2020, and life under Biden. And it's like, you know, it's a beautiful thing we had. I'm not going to do the accent, it's too early in the morning, but it's a beautiful thing we had. We had prosperity for everybody, people with college degrees, people who don't have high school degrees, for Black people, for Asian people. And it didn't at all feel like box checking or defensive at all. It felt like he was happy about this. And it also reflects that, as we've mentioned a time or two, and the New York Times definitely had in their various polling, he's polling. If really it's about like white people being scared of brown people, man, the brown people aren't getting the memo.
Yeah.
They're getting a different memo.
Yeah.
That's weird. Are you saying that they're voting against their own interests, Rachel Maddow?
Yes.
Of course. The crime thing is interesting, too, because you both have the immigration and the crime thing, and you have Jen Psaki saying, oh, I live in Virginia. And, you know, I don't remember who said this exactly, they use the city as code for crime and everything's out of control, and Rachel Maddow you know, who lives in a castle somewhere and gets $30 million a year to have one show a week, says, oh my God, can you believe these people? Right as they're saying this, this is something that happened probably an hour before they talked about this. This is from the city that they, some of them have lived in or some of them currently live in, and that's DC. The Secure DC Omnibus Amendment Act of 2024 includes more than 100 proposals to help fight crime in our nation's capital. And because 2023, this is a news story, by the way, it's not like a Wall Street Journal editorial. 2023 ended with the highest number of homicides DC has seen in more than 25 years, and carjackings nearly doubled. So if you want to take America,
50 years, Moynihan, come on.
Well, yeah, you can move those goalposts. As I always point out, I love it. It's like we have had the number of terrorist deaths we've had since September 12th, 2001. It's like, all right, I guess you're starting there. But this thing, and this is not to say that those numbers that they're citing can't be justified or they're wrong. I'm not an expert in this stuff. But when you talk about Fox News, when you talk about Trump, and they're the people that are responsible for the fear. And by the way, I did this morning, Google News search, like crime spike myth is 1,000 mm-hmm. articles about it. But you know what's not a myth is that every time I go into a fucking Target, I can't get anything without getting someone to open one of the cases because everything is now encased.
But
right?
Did you know, Michael, that there's less shoplifting today than there was in 1775?
Yeah. You know, John Calhoun opened the first Target and it was, you could just take things.
The general sleight of hand is comparing the murder rate now in big cities to 2020 and sexy. It's gone down.
Yeah, well, exactly. And that was the biggest
2020
spike
was the biggest spike here. And that's why I don't believe actually, and I haven't seen this the first time I heard it, that 50-year number, because generally speaking, in big cities in the country, spike went up so high in 2020, it hasn't come back down to 2019 levels.
That's right.
And people live with that. They'd see a net increase.
And by the way, when I say this, and the people who will inevitably send emails about this, when I say, oh, you know, the targets, whatever, I'm not saying that that means that crime has gone up or gone down, but I'm just talking about the idea that the perception comes from Donald Trump or comes from Newsmax or these people that surely absolutely puff up the crime stuff and the migrant crime stuff, which, you know, there's really no evidence for, but it's hard to kind of quantify. But it's just the general perception of this. What would you like the media to do? Not report on what's happening in San Francisco? The worst is Oakland. I mean, Oakland is in complete death
spiral. But also, why is this a federal thing? Why are we talking about this at a federal election? I mean, surely crime is a localized thing. Yeah. No, I mean, with the exception of the impact that a collapsing immigration policy has, it strikes me that you know, state police forces and cities are responsible for law and order. And what's a bit weird in the states, and I was just in California and in the flaming trash heap that is San Francisco. Only kidding. It's a lovely city.
It's not flaming. It's just a trash heap.
It's smoldering at this point. What's a little weird to a foreigner is that, like, the left in America is so much more left than the left in the places that the left in America likes.
Sweden, for instance.
You know, I did a semester of university in Copenhagen and, you know, I lived in the UK, grew up in Australia. These are places, well, with the possible exception of the UK, which are more progressive than the United States. There's no way we would tolerate the shit you guys are putting up with. Yeah. We would crack down. We wouldn't have tents. The moment there was a tent on a street in Copenhagen or Sydney, the cops would be like, yeah, no, that's not what you do. You don't do that. You move along, thank you. And if shoplifting was on the rise, then the police would cooperate with the big stores to figure out what to do about it. They wouldn't start locking away the shavers.
Yes.
a big problem.
Here in the States is your city tries to pass an ordinance to forbid this company from leaving.
That's right.
Have to stay and tolerate the shoplifting and various other signs of social decline because we say so.
Mm-hmm. There's a really large mistake made by a lot of progressives and not a small number of self-identified libertarians in the push for pushing long overdue criminal justice reforms, particularly bail reform, but also the war on drugs, rolling that back, which I think the war on drugs especially has been great. It's been a boon to roll that back. But in the push for that, Measure 110 in Oregon, which just got modified, is part of this. Many, if not most of those reformists decided to turn a willful blind eye against public disorder. And if you, and not only that, but like saying that those of us who live among public disorder and talking about it are being reactionary, playing into the right wing, and that your eyes are lying to you, and that if you go against public disorder, you're just trying to give cops reason to do whatever they want with impunity. So they're telling people that what they're seeing isn't true, and that public disorder is the inevitable cost of more freedom for everybody else. And that's going to lose the political argument. And the people are not facing that directly. And we should talk about that.
People will leave the state as they have been doing. I mean, a lot of Californians have gone to Austin, where I was yesterday, because they, you know, they don't believe that it's a human right to shit in the street.
There's a lot of homeless people in Austin, by the way.
Yeah, they just, I don't know where you were, but they just re-elected their progressive DA there, too.
I would say one final thing, this, and I know Josh has to go, is that Sweden is a good example of this. And I went on a bit of an intemperate rant, I think maybe on a subscriber episode, about immigration, and got a lot of pushback, some of which I think the people who corrected me were probably right about things. Yeah. And
the rivers of blood are maybe not all made out of blood.
Well, it was, he said the Tiber foams with blood. He never said rivers of blood, by the way. Enoch Powell is much maligned. No, I'm joking. Enoch Powell was a nutcase. But I said a few things, but someone sent an email about, you know, every other country does this, you know, will deport someone if they, I said, are you not paying attention to Europe? And I said, you know, in my head, I was like, maybe I'm just assuming that people know this, but that's correct, that there are certain places in Europe that don't do that. And there's a lot of EU regulations, et cetera. The one thing that changes it in Sweden, in Norway, in Denmark, they started their immigration pushback with a political, like, there's a political valence to it. When you have a bunch of people from Ecuador or, you know, people from Nicaragua or Venezuela or Cuba who are escaping sort of communist tyranny, they're not coming. They're coming here. Some of them are political. Some of them are not. In Norway, I remember when I first was in Scandinavia, there was a big push to get rid of Mulla Krekar, who was a radical Kurdish Islamist. And so all of that stuff about immigration was all about Islamism, because then there were attacks and said, oh, you know, they'll only attack people if they're involved in Iraq. And then that turned out not to be true. There was attacks in Sweden, et cetera. So that is where it, and then the other thing, and Camille mentions this. We have this very similar thing. Camille mentions this. I say yes. And Matt says, well, the quote's not entirely right, but it is the Milton Friedman quote about, which is say, it's like, you know, free immigration, open borders is great until the welfare state plays a role. And whether or not that's the exact quote doesn't make a difference, because in Sweden, that is actually a serious issue, because people right, left, and center, I've had people that are quote unquote conservatives arguing strenuously that the state should run the liquor stores. There's a Swedish mindset. And once it is like, okay, all of the hospitals are now people getting primary care, you know, because they have a cold or something and they're, you know, not going to a doctor, et cetera. And it's all migrants, right? That's how I noticed that they talked about it when I was doing a piece in Austria. All the Austrians, when they were talking about immigration, were talking about healthcare. They say, oh, the healthcare system's overwhelmed. I'm like, why? Yeah, you know how it goes. Mm. They're like, oh, you're talking about this was right after the big migration wave in 2015. And that is the thing. They worry about the health of the welfare state.
Right. But this is a failure of government. I mean, this happens in Australia as well.
Yeah.
The way that you talk about immigration and the way that critics of immigration talk about it is not to say that like brown people or that they don't like migrants. They say, look how clogged the roads are. Look at the strains on our schools. Look at the strains on our hospitals.
Yeah.
And like a case can be made and has been made eloquently by a former premier of New South Wales, which is like a governor of the most populous state, who was a lefty. But now he says we have to curb the immigration rate significantly, because the reality is that state governments are not going to invest the amount that they would need to invest in hospitals, schools, parks, roads, public transportation, and other infrastructure to cope with the increase in population. Doesn't matter who they are or where they're coming from, just the sheer number of people. So for me, okay, well then just make sure that you're on the same page. Mm-hmm. And every time the federal government says, okay, an extra 100,000 people are coming in, they have to be coordinated with the state government to say, all right, X number of hospitals and schools are going to be required. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not rocket science to me. That's just good governance. Yeah. And the fact that it's not being done is not the fault of immigration.
I think that we should have a debate on this podcast. I'm very serious about this too, because when, you know, you have someone like Joy Reid says race, it's about black people, brown people. They want to push them across the border. They don't want them in their communities. There is a version of that that is not, it's not that at all, but there's a version of a slight version of it that is worth debating that people don't debate. It doesn't, Douglas Murray talks about this, and I'd love to have people from two sides on this.
is that, is there a debate to be had? And this is very, very serious debate that's happening now in Europe vis-a-vis Gaza, right? That cultural change, massive cultural change, is a worthy point of debate about immigration. That was always considered off limits because it was taken to be racist, right? You don't want these people that come from the Middle East, you're Islamophobic, et cetera. Is there an actual conversation to be had about this issue that is not racist, that is totally sensible, when you have Sweden loves being Swedish and 10%, 11% of the population now is foreign born? Now, those are kind of juice numbers because a lot of people are born in Finland, right? Finland's Svensk. But there's still a huge number of people born outside. And the reason that the far right party is now the number two party in Sweden, sometimes it even polls at number one, is because of the idea of Swedishness, but no one will talk about it. And I just wonder if there is a conversation about that that does not descend to the Joy Reid level of discourse and can be had and say, well, I guarantee you, I mean, the Japanese are very obvious about this. I don't think that, you know, the Syrians would be super happy about this if there was, you know, Christian culture coming in.
They love Jews.
They love them.
Nation states are weird, man.
Yeah.
Well, I'll talk to Douglas Murray about it on our upcoming live tour of Australia, which you can hear on Uncomfortable Conversations. We're all good.
Do you have to be gay to listen to that?
Yeah, you do.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't. How do you, is it like a fingerprint
how
scan?
We just know.
Do you get it? Oh.
That's how you walk down the street.
We're keeping spreadsheets, my name.
Yeah. Although, he said Nate Silver is gay. Yeah. You did say that earlier.
I didn't say that. You said that.
No, I said that he's gay,
and
you were like,
"I know that."
Yeah, but you know who he is.
Yeah.
So your gaydar was clearly broken.
You have to meet the person.
Really?
I don't know.
Get on a plane.
Way to throw a stink bomb.
Okay, I'm getting out of here.
All right.
All right. Man.
Thanks, Josh, guys.
Thanks, Josh.
Thank you, Josh.
Delight as always.
Delight as always.
Bye. Bye.